You're listening to a 3CR podcast recorded in the 3CR Community Radio Studio in Melbourne, Australia. If you like what you hear, please consider donating or subscribing so we can keep bringing you more independent community content. For more information, go to 3cr.org.au.
This is 3CR Breakfast. Oh, yeah. Alternative news, analysis, and current affairs. Monday to Friday, 7 a.m. to 8:30 a.m.
Only double.
Grab your pants.
Good morning, listeners. Welcome to another Wednesday breakfast. It's 7 a.m. on the 23rd of April, and it's going to be about 21 degrees today, I think. It was a bit chilly when we woke up this morning. But you're here with myself, Jesse, and...
Nita is here too. Good morning, listeners.
Morning, everyone.
How cold and dark and chilly it suddenly is.
It's just us two this morning, but we should be joined by other Wednesday breakfasters next week, and potentially some new voices. We'll see. I don't know. Maybe
anything's possible.
Right? Yeah.
Today on the show, we've got quite a few things. I think we might have to actually decide whether we'll get through all of it, but we'll tell you what could be coming up. Maybe it'll be one less.
Yes. Because there's, you know, it's a current affairs show, so there's things that are happening every moment of every day, and some of them are important to cover, and, you know, also, you know, timely. So we'll see what we can do. We've got a few things that we'd like to play to the listeners this morning. But what we can say for now is that after the news headlines, we'll play part two of the interview I did with Marcus Rubenstein on China. And Marcus is an independent journalist of 25 years. And you know, has worked across all the major news organizations as well, and is currently the author of the Anti-China Media Watch column on Pearls and Irritations, the johnmenadue.com website, where they do lots of great, excellent independent journalism. And so, yeah, we might listen to that one a bit after the news headlines. And then after that, I interviewed Sunday from Anuk Bayan, Melbourne. And Anuk Bayan are a really incredible organization, a youth-focused organization as part of the broader Bayan, which is a national democratic movement in the Philippines. And because there are such a large diaspora of people coming from the Philippines, necessarily for economic reasons, Anuk Bayan and Bayan have a large presence internationally as well. So we chat about what that means, what national democratic movement means, and also the situation in the Philippines for people.
Thereafter, we listen to the first part of an interview which Rosie from the Climate Action Show held with Jeremy Walker. And Jeremy Walker speaks about his work exposing the Atlas Network and goes into how he found out about the network, its history and makeup, and previous research and understanding about it. So the Atlas Network is an internationally coordinated body that has been working behind the scenes for years to shape public opinion and government policies which favor corporate interests and profits. For example, the Atlas Network was a big player behind the conservative no vote at the referendum. And they just, do lots of horrible things. So it'll be good to find out about their machinations and be aware, especially because you can bet the meddling ahead of the elections. So that will be our third segment. And we really hope to get to our final segment, which will be a speech from yesterday's rally calling for justice for Abdi Fattah Ahmed, who was shot and killed by Victoria Police in Central Footscray last Thursday on the 17th of April. So the speech is given by Farah Warsame, who is a Somali community leader, and she calls for justice, transparency and accountability in the face of Abdi Fattah's tragic death. So that's what we have ahead for you this morning, listeners. Lots. But before then, of course, we will go into the news headlines.
Some folks know about it, some don't. Some will learn to shout it, some won't. But sooner or later, baby, here's a ditty. Say you're gonna have to get right down to the real nitty gritty. Let's get right down to the real nitty gritty. Now one, two, nitty gritty. Now yeah, boom, nitty gritty.
And these are the news headlines for this Wednesday, 23rd of April, 2025. You're listening to Wednesday Breakfast on 3CR. So first up, the US military launched a deadly attack on Yemen's Ras Issa oil port in Hodeidah on April 17th, killing at least 58 workers and injuring over 126, including paramedics, in one of the bloodiest strikes since Washington resumed its bombing campaign last month. US Central Command, CENTCOM, claimed the strikes aimed to deprive the Yemeni government of quote-unquote illegal revenue used to fund regional quote-unquote terrorism, alleging the port financed Houthi operations. Yemen's Sana'a government condemned the assault as a war crime, accusing Washington of deliberately targeting civilian infrastructure and lying to mislead the world. Footage from Yemeni media showed charred bodies and raging fires at the site, which Sana'a insists is solely used for civilian oil exports and storage. The Ras Issa attack followed U.S. air strikes in central Yemen's Mukairas district and near Sana'a, part of a daily bombing campaign since March 15, when President Donald Trump intensified efforts to counter Yemen's blockade of Israeli shipping in the Red Sea and retaliate for drone attacks on Israel. Yemen's armed forces, allied with Ansar Allah, have responded with 78 missile and drone strikes against U.S. warships and Israel, including a ballistic missile launched hours after the Ras Issa bombing that triggered sirens in Tel Aviv. Despite Washington's claims of degrading Houthi capabilities, the Yemen armed forces continue to target U.S. assets, underscoring the failure of the campaign to deter resistance.
Moscow has officially ratified its comprehensive strategic partnership with Tehran, cementing sovereign cooperation in crucial areas like national security, peaceful nuclear energy development, and mutual defense against coercive Western economic sanctions. This finalization underscores the strengthening of ties between Russia and Iran, nations united in resisting the relentless and often unwarranted pressure campaign waged by the United States. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov highlighted the pact as a necessary assertion against, quote, third-party coercion, a clear reference to Washington's meddling regarding Iran's legitimate nuclear program. The enhanced alliance includes vital Russian support for Iran's nuclear program, including the ongoing expansion of the Bushehr power plant, ensuring energy independence. This occurs amidst regional instability largely fueled by U.S. interference and Israeli threats of aggression, further compounded by Western allegations regarding Iran's nuclear activities. As Washington obstructs meaningful diplomacy, this strengthened Russia-Indian partnership represents a crucial bulwark against further destabilization attempts by the United States and its regional allies seeking to dictate terms over Tehran's sovereign rights to nuclear technology.
And Beijing has firmly denounced the United States' economic coercion and has vowed to retaliate against any nation that submits to Washington's demands at the expense of its trade relationship with China. This strong warning follows reports detailing the Trump administration's manipulative tactics to pressure countries into curtailing legitimate trade with China, employing coercive financial measures and false promises of improved terms as leverage. China's Commerce Ministry has explicitly stated its resolute opposition to any agreements made at the expense of China's interests, asserting that Beijing will resolutely take countermeasures against such damaging actions dictated by the US. This stance emerges as Washington engages in a widespread campaign of economic aggression, hypocritically suspending tariffs on certain nations while unfairly targeting China with punitive measures, escalating the total tariff burden on Chinese goods to an exorbitant 145% without any sign of relief. The ministry declared that appeasement will not bring peace and compromise will not earn respect, cautioning nations against such self-destructive compliance. It further asserted that pursuing illusory exemptions by sacrificing others for selfish and short-sighted gains under U.S. duress is akin to negotiating with a tiger for its skin, ultimately resulting in a lose-lose situation. Reports suggest Washington's scheme involves pressuring allies to impede the transit of Chinese goods, obstruct Chinese companies relocating to circumvent unjust U.S. tariffs, and reject competitive Chinese imports, a blatant interference in sovereign economic matters.
Western media focus has shifted to Somaliland as it aligns with Israeli and U.S. efforts to forcibly relocate Gaza's population, exploiting the unrecognized region as a potential dumping ground. Reports suggest Tel Aviv and Washington are secretly negotiating with the capital, Hargeisa, flouting international law and Palestinian rights. This comes as the Financial Times admission has revealed U.S. discussions on recognizing Somaliland in exchange for a military base near Berbera, exposing imperial ambitions to secure an African foothold amid declining influence and to provoke China and Russia. The U.S. has long eyed Somaliland for its strategic value, as seen in Trump's Project 2025, which advocates recognition to undermine China and Djibouti. Britain's entrenched control over Somaliland's security and media foreshadows a future of repression for any displaced Palestinians, potentially trapped in yet another Western-backed open-air prison.
And finally, Hamas has privately informed mediators it would halt weapons development and tunnel construction if a long-term truce with Israel is secured, according to Times of Israel sources. The group reportedly agreed to cede governance of Gaza to an independent Palestinian technocratic body, aligning with Egypt's 2023 proposal for a post-war community support committee led by factions across Palestine. While Hamas publicly insists retaining arms is a red line, some officials allegedly signaled willingness to store weapons in supervised warehouses under a joint Egyptian-European security framework, part of a broader Arab League-endorsed reconstruction plan worth tens of billions. The proposal, however, faces hurdles as Israel rejects Palestinian Authority involvement in Gaza, even as Egyptian plans envision PA, Palestinian Authority governments, replacing Hamas. The truce talks unfold as Israel's renewed ground offensive claims over 50% of Gaza, displacing 1.4 million and killing nearly 2,000 since December. Hamas's Qassam brigades continue resistance operations, ambushing Israeli forces in Beit Hanun and maintaining 75% of Rafah's tunnel network intact. Despite heavy bombardment, Hamas retains rocket capabilities and has recruited thousands of new fighters, underscoring its resilience. Meanwhile, Egypt's phased reconstruction plan, aimed at eventual Palestinian statehood, clashes with Tel Aviv's refusal to engage the Palestinian Authority, leaving Gaza's political future uncertain. As violence escalates, mediators grapple with reconciling Hamas's conditional concessions with Israel's hardline demands and ongoing military entrenchment. And those have been the news headlines for this Wednesday morning, the 23rd of April. It's 13 minutes past 7. And you're listening to Wednesday Breakfast.
3CR would like to thank our sponsors, Earth Greetings, cards that connect, care, and celebrate. Support wildlife and habitat with every purchase. Inspired by nature, giving back to the planet. Learn more at earthgreetings.com.au.
And you're back with us. It's 14 minutes past 7 now. We're going to go to an interview I did with Marcus Rubenstein. This is the second and last part of the interview we did together. Marcus Rubenstein is an independent journalist with many different outlets over his career of more than 25 years, but he's also spent a significant amount of time in China and studying China and writing about China, as well as photographing China, actually. And so in this part and final part of the interview, we touch on a range of things, but also focus on the tariffs, which we've just spoken about in the news headlines. So yeah, have a listen to that.
A week or two ago, the Chinese embassy remarked that it was ready for, quote, any type of war in response, and that was in response to the trade war instigated by the United States and these tariffs. I thought that was remarkable because, you know, they're saying any type of war. I don't know if I'm reading too much into it, but, you know, I think that maybe there is something to that wording, and you know, China's always had a policy of non-interference, as outlined in its five principles of peaceful coexistence. I wondered what you were thinking about that, if you thought about that, and if there's something to that when they've said that they're ready for basically anything.
Look, I think sometimes you shouldn't read too much into what Chinese say, particularly because it's, you know things are lost in translation, and whatever, you know, whatever Chinese Foreign Office spokespeople might say in their English announcements, be it written or in interviews or in speeches. It was drafted in Chinese and had to do it in Chinese.
Yeah.
So there is a bit of lust in translation there. I think the message China's been trying to send out for years is that, you know, we're a peer competitor to the United States. It's almost as though the narrative, or, you know, I believe part of that narrative is to the United States, will you either treat us like a peer or treat us like an enemy? And China is feels as though it's being treated like an enemy by the United States, so it's reacting like an enemy. In terms of a trade war, I mean, this trade war is not really a trade war. This global trade war started by Trump. Is hurting everyone. It's wiped the value off share markets everywhere. In a funny sort of a way, it's an indicator of just how much, well, America's lost its global prestige. I think that's Trump is accelerating that, but it still maintains its global power. The US dollar is still the reserve currency. The US is still, well, in purchasing power parity, which is one of the measures of GDP, it's roughly the same size. Some might argue that China is bigger than the US. Essentially, purchasing power parity is not a headline number of this is the US dollar output of an economy. It's, well, this is how much money is generated in the economy, and this is what it buys. So in that respect, China's taken over or very, very close to the United States. But, you know, the US, through one stroke of a pen, and I'm sure everyone's seen it on the media, Trump signing these executive orders, and it's with his massive signature down the bottom with these black texters. It's created turmoil and around the world, and it's just a very, very simplistic, you know, response to endemic problems with the US economy. They've outsourced production because, you know, the American, you know, jobs and workers, you know, an industry is no longer efficient. It's no longer competitive. And it's one of the issues of becoming a developed economy. You swing towards the services sector and manufacturing misses out, then manufacturing inevitably gets offshored. China is starting to offshore its manufacturing. It's looking to Vietnam and increasingly Thailand and other places because its costs of production are high in various parts of China. If you look at Australia, you know there are Teslas all over the roads here, and I wouldn't drive a Tesla for a variety of reasons, the thing is with Teslas here, and Tesla drivers seem to be very happy with them, they're all made in China. And a lot of them will say, I'm glad this is made in China because they're better made than the US ones. You know, your factory Tesla factory workers in the US are making, you know, I wouldn't say they'd be making much more than an average wage there. Whereas Chinese Tesla factory workers are on very good money. There's an incentive for them to make a quality product. And now poor old Elon Musk has you know has so closely aligned himself with Donald Trump. He's created, and for him, the guy's so fabulously wealthy, I suppose it doesn't matter. But he's destroying the value, the listed market value of his companies. He's getting Tesla owners to hand back, wanting to get rid of their cars because generally the person who'll drive in the United States, who'll drive an environmentally friendly electric car, is not a Trump supporter, and so he's sort of pushing people to one side. But tariffs are a very, very blunt object, which consumers ultimately pay the price. They're inflationary, and they do very little. Australia was a very high tariff economy up until the late 1990s. The mid 1990s, things started to come off, and even into the late 1990s, we were a very high tariff economy. And what it does is it makes industries inefficient. I mean, if you're a if you're an older listener and a student of economics, the classic one was the old TCF, which was the textile, clothing, and footwear. These industries were protected by such enormous tariffs that firstly, these things became very expensive. I mean, you can walk into a shop and buy a business shirt virtually in any shopping center in Australia today in 2025, and it's cheaper than it was in 40 years ago in 1985. I mean, we gave, sucker, if you want, in terms of, I don't want to confuse the sucker means you're weaning, an industry which was highly inefficient, which produced products which were well above, global prices, and that's what tariffs did. And so, they're a blunt object. They're very inefficient, and it's causing global pain. It's hurting the US consumers. And coming back in a very long roundabout sort of a way to your question, China can fight it off because China can do trade with other nations. But China's developing an economy whose growth is more and more and more reliant on domestic consumption. Now, China has its internal problems. It has high youth unemployment. It has relatively flat, historically, over the last 30 years compared to that, relatively flat economic growth. It has high government debt. But I guess the one thing about the Chinese is they see their problems and they address them. They're not, one of the advantages of being a one-party state is as you see now in the midst of a federal election campaign where Liberal and Labor are throwing money around like there's no tomorrow, which would raise the questions: if these were such political imperatives, why didn't you do them 3 years ago when you got into power? But in one-party states, they don't really need to throw these things around. They see a problem and they fix it, and so that's what the Chinese government is trying to do. And they feel as though they can compete with America on a parity basis. So they're really, in a protracted trade war. China, and particularly, in terms of a blunt tariff policy, I think China has a lot more outs than the US, and that's of concern to the US people, and in the short term, concerns to the global economy.
Thanks, Marcus. Well, we're coming to the end of our time. Was there anything else that you think listeners should know or think about, perhaps, in regards to China and Australia and maybe the West, more broadly? The position and yeah, what are the maybe an important takeaways or anything else that you'd like to mention?
Look, I've been accused of being too pro-China. I'm not starry-eyed about China. I have a lot of Chinese friends. I've traveled to China many times, principally as a photographer. And for people who know my work, the themes I have are photographing ordinary Chinese people doing, living their everyday lives. I find people fascinating. And one of the greater compliments I get about my work is that, through my lens, I see what's going on behind people's lives. I want to tell a story. It's not just a picture of someone. It's a story of them, of their lives. So I have the same view, of all people. I guess from a personal perspective, COVID helped change my views. I figured the racism expressed towards the Asian community, and as I said, I've got many, many good friends, not just from China, but from all over Asia. And I thought to myself, I can't be offended of anti-Asian, influences because I'm dating a Chinese girl, and I've got lots of Chinese friends. That would be hypocritical on my part. So one of the things I've done for the last 4 years, and of course this will be my fifth year, is doing some volunteer work around Refugee Week and helping with refugee resettlement, social enterprises. And it's great. And I've been exposed to people from Pakistan, from Afghanistan, from Iraq, Iran, Bangladesh, from Ukraine, and from Northern Africa. And these people have been great, and they fundamentally come in because they want a better life. And then, election time, you've got people running around, well, you've got conservatives in particular running around saying, oh, that they're a potential drain on our economy, and they cause law and order issues. They only want to come here and get on to welfare and make this a worse place. So I'm very much pro people. I'm not starry-eyed about China. China has a lot of problems. It is an increasingly, I wouldn't say an aggressive state, but an assertive state. It poses, and when I say not aggressive, China's been involved in one conflict, apart from several skirmishes, and I really mean skirmishes. In its borders with India, was involved in a 4-week war against the Vietnam in the tail end of the Vietnam War, and so that it's not an expansionist state. Yes, it's building islands in the South China Sea, in areas it's traditionally regarded as their own. Now these are heavily disputed islands, and China might have a claim, but equally other countries like the Philippines, most notably, they have claims as well. But quite often you hear the narrative from the West that these are very important trade routes. Yeah, they are very important trade routes for China, and they have an interest in protecting, the maritime movements of shipping, of commercial shipping. And one of the points that I try to make is that this body of water that the Chinese are claiming is called the South China Sea. No one disputes the fact that it's the South China Sea, but people in the West dispute the fact that China has, claims in a sea named after China. But these are where the lines are blurred. Same with Taiwan. I've been to Fujian province, which is in the east of China. Taiwan's islands stretch almost under the Chinese mainland. So from Xiamen, which is the eastern coastal city in Fujian province, you can actually see the outer Taiwan islands. I mean, they're visible by the naked eye. And according to what the US has determined as Taiwanese airspace, if you're flying out of Xiamen Airport, the moment the wheels lift off the tarmac, you're automatically in Taiwanese airspace. So these are very nuanced issues, and so look, I guess there has to be balance in this argument, but essentially, it's hard to see it ever coming there. I think America will possibly be forced into a position where they become increasingly isolated, and they'll look for compromise. One of the points, and I'll try and finish on this, is Yiannis Varoufakis, who was the former Greek finance minister and a prominent, left-wing media commentator in Europe, who was for a brief time a lecturer at Sydney University, and I think his daughter spent a lot of time in Australia. Varoufakis wrote a book in recent years called Techno-Feudalism, which argues, I guess, the case against what technology companies are doing, globally, how they're having such an impact on our lives. But the interesting point Varoufakis makes is that the major global technology companies are all essentially American. Facebook, Instagram, all part of the same company. YouTube, Amazon X, or formerly Twitter. These technology platforms are all US. I think nine out of the 10 biggest companies in the world, I think the top six, are all US technology companies. Europe's nowhere to be seen. There's none of America's allies are even close to being on the map of technology. China, on the other hand, has major technology. It's developing its own technology. It has an army of engineers. And mathematicians, people who have the requisite skills to develop technology, and they're doing it. And it poses a real risk to America. I mean, you've got companies like Huawei have been banned because of their alleged links to the Chinese military. And yes, of course, they do work for the Chinese government, and their technology ends up with the military. But I spoke to an IBM security consultant some years ago, and I asked him his thoughts on Huawei. He said, "Look, I don't know the Huawei issue that well." He said, "But I do know this much: there's nothing that Huawei is capable of doing, rather than actually doing, that the U.S. government hasn't been doing to its own people for the past decade." And the reality is, at the end of the day, Mozambique, an emerging, essentially third world African country, has far better internet and 5G mobile technology than we do in Australia. And that's what China has to offer, the global South, and effectively they're carving out Europe and the United States. Europe has become fractured. You had the UK Brexit; it's pulled out. Now, then it's the EU is not as strong as it once was, and it's unlikely to get stronger in this era of nationalism, almost hyper-nationalism. And China is—it's not even dividing and conquering; it's just going into those parts of the world that should have been left out. And that's an issue that America will need to address, and hopefully they can, because as much as I think it's dangerous living in a unipolar world where America controls everything, I think for different reasons it's equally dangerous to live in a unipolar world where China controls everything, There needs to be a balance. The US doesn't want it. China, I suspect, will live in a compromised world where it shares power with the United States. But given the alternatives, if China can become the unipolar power and dictate its policies to the rest of the world, it will. And I don't think that's a good thing.
Okay. Thanks so much for that analysis, Marcus. That was really great to hear from someone like yourself, who's spent such a long time not only in China itself, but also, of course, studying and obviously have a wealth of knowledge in regards to the Australian system here and the Chinese system. So thanks so much for your time.
My pleasure, Jesse.
Your boy Race Rage, Jamaica Moana.
Hey, it's your boy Race Rage, and you're here on 8:55 a.m. on 3CR.
And yes, you're back with us on Wednesday breakfast at 7:35 a.m. You're listening to 3CR 8:55 a.m. And you could be listening on the playback service on the website or through the community radio app. We just heard an interview with Marcus Rubenstein. That was the last part of a two-part interview I did regarding his column, Anti-China Media Watch, on the Pearls and Irritations Public Policy Journal. We're now going to go to an interview with Sunday. Sunday is from Anak Bayan, Melbourne. And Anak Bayan is a comprehensive national democratic mass organization of the Filipino youth based here in Melbourne that seeks to arouse, organize, and mobilize young Filipino workers, students, professionals, migrants, and national minorities for national democracy, and to merge this movement with the powerful movement of the toiling masses. And so Anak Bayan recognizes the historical role of youth as a powerful force that advocates and advances social change against a rotten and old social system. So we'll learn from Sunday about the history of the struggle in the Philippines, the history of colonization and imperial war, as well as we'll go a bit into what Anak Bayan is and why it exists.
So maybe we can get started talking a bit about the history of the Philippines, and we could even go all the way back to colonization and then to the independence movement, and then to, you know, it's quite a lot of time to cover.
Yeah.
But it's obviously it's important context.
Yeah, of course. So for me to be able to answer this question comprehensively, I have to dive like a little bit deeper in Philippine history due to like the 500 years long colonization that occurred in the archipelago. So before Spanish colonization, the Philippines actually did not exist as a nation. All the other parts of the archipelago were separated from each other. And there was three different social systems that existed during that time. The most extensive social system that existed in the barangays or the neighborhoods was the semi-slave and semi-communal system. So it was ruled by the Rajas and Datus. So they were basically the ruling class of those neighborhoods. And that existed all throughout the Philippines. So they extracted land rent from the slaves as well as their harvests. And then we have the most advanced social system that existed in the Moro Sultanates in Mindanao and Sulu, which was feudalism. So the sultanates were able to extract land rent in the form of religious taxes from the tillers. So due to their advanced systems, they actually had an economic and political unity that frustrated the Spanish colonialists from conquering them, and then therefore failed in doing so. So they were like, along with the Igorot people, who are an indigenous tribe in the Philippines who live in the mountains, who were able to use the terrain to fight the Spanish colonialists. they were the only groups or like parts of the Philippines that was not conquered by Spain during that time. And then we have the last system, which is the primitive communal. So the primitive communal system was practiced by the Aeta tribe. So they're another indigenous group from the Philippines. There was no private ownership in this system, and they made a living through fishing, gathering, foraging, etc. And they, you know, they shared it equal. They divided it equally amongst the tribal members. So, I'm going through like the pre-colonization time in the Philippines, so that we'll be able to understand better how did the colonization happen in the first place, and how, you know, these social systems contributed to that. So, the Spanish colonized the Philippines for 333 years, and they used the tactic of divide and conquer, as well as sword of the cross. Because the barangays or the neighborhoods, like I said before, like they had the lack of political unity, the Spanish was able to take advantage of that. And hence why like they used the divide and conquer tactic. And the sword of the cross is basically like, you know, you either assimilate to the colonization or you'll get killed. Like you get like assimilate into Christianity, etc. And so the Spanish propagated feudalism throughout the country. They used the encomienda and hacienda system. So those are both feudal systems that, you know, in relation to landlords and peasantry. So the encomienda system entrusted large tracts of lands to Spanish officials and friars, which was later on disbanded and then changed to the hacienda system. So the hacienda system, on the other hand, was a large-scale cultivation of crops used to export to capitalist countries like Europe. So the hacienda system persists even today. So there's still existing haciendas all over the Philippines. These feudal systems, you know, like were used to enforce land grabbing, exorbitant land rent, and exploitative labor to the peasantry. So due to these conditions, the invigoration of commerce in and outside the country resulted in the emergence of the embryo of the Filipino working class and the Filipino bourgeoisie. So throughout the Spanish colonization, no less than 200 revolts of varying duration and influence happened in the Philippines. We found that the Filipino people found it necessary, given the exploitation and oppression that they are experiencing, to resist and unite against the colonial forces that are subjugating them. So these revolts were led by the peasantry and the embryo of the Filipino working class, and it gained strength and also created a great, you know, tradition for the Filipino people of resistance. Another form or like another movement that occurred during Spanish colonization was led by the Ilustrados. So the Ilustrados were the children of the Principalia, or what we can call now is like, I guess, like the local ruling class in the Philippines during that time. So because the interests of their parents were being threatened, so the interest being like wanting to be included in the economic, you know, the economy in the Philippines, wanting to be part of the system under the Spanish colonization, that was being threatened throughout the Spanish colonial era as well. So they participated in movements that are more focused on reforms. So this includes the secularization movement. So this was during the time when Filipino priests, they demanded the expulsion of the religious orders from the parishes. And the leaders of this movement, of the secularization movement, was Father Gomez, Burgos, and Zamora. And they were executed because they were being accused of conspiring the mutiny that happened in Cavite during that time, which is like another revolt that was led by the workers there. And so they were, yeah, they were executed, they were guillotined in front of the people. And then another movement that the Ilustrados led was the propaganda movement. So the propaganda movement was only aiming for the Philippines to be a province of Spain. However, you know, this movement met failure. It didn't really accomplish what it was trying to do. And so, it was led by the likes of Jose Rizal, who, you know, someone that is like has studied in Europe and then came back to the Philippines.
You're listening to a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online. Now stay tuned to hear the rest of your 3CR podcast.
Kind of like wanting to like share or like, you know, or to influence the Filipino people with the liberal ideas that he had, because, you know, like the bourgeois revolutions were happening in Europe during that time. And so while he was there, he took upon those ideas and tried to apply it in Philippine society. And so he came back after the propaganda movement from Europe to the Philippines, and he established La Liga Filipina. La Liga Filipina is like a secret society, so it only really included as well like the children of the ruling class, which were the Ilustrados. But it was through La Liga Filipina that Jose Rizal called on the Filipinos to stand as a nation. So he preempted, you know, that the Filipino people are united as a nation, and that we are not separated in terms of like, you know, the geography and the difference of our cultures and everything. So he already preempted that there is a nation that, you know, unites the Filipino people. So in contrary to the Ilustrados movement and class, they were limited in fighting for reforms, and they didn't really organize amongst the toiling masses. So in contrary to them, the Katipunan wage an armed struggle. So this was led by Andres Bonifacio, and the Katipunan was compromised by Filipino peasantry and working class, who, you know, like had national democratic aspirations to liberate the Philippines from Spanish rule. So while the oppression and exploitation worsened, the fighting spirit of the toiling masses still dominated until the 1896 Philippine Revolution broke out. So the Spanish colonialists were driven out of many parts of the country. And, you know, the power of Spain also was gradually weakened due to other competing capitalist nations during this time, and as well as the revolutionary struggles of the people in other Spanish colonies, they were also advancing. So, you know, the Filipino people, the Katipunan, took advantage of these conditions and waged an armed struggle fighting for national democracy in the Philippines. And, you know, the victory that rightfully belonged to the Filipino revolutionaries was actually denied them, because the Spanish ended up selling the Philippines along with its other colonies for $20 million under the Treaty of Paris to the United States. So we kind of like the Filipino people, you know, like we were, the Filipino revolutionaries were already like making way to kick out the Spanish occupiers, only for a new occupier to come and steal like the struggle and the fight that they have been doing for so long. And yeah, and then the enter of U.S. imperialism started in the Philippines after that. So before the U.S. could control, you know, the large part of the archipelago, the imperialists subjugated the Filipino people in an all-out war. So not a lot of people are aware that this happened, because of the whitewashing of our history, but it's actually what is now called the Filipino-American War. So this war killed around 1 to 1.5 million Filipinos. And the conservative estimate that, like, you know, some will tell you is like only 200,000 Filipinos were killed, but actually there were more than that. And, you know, U.S. imperialism committed atrocious acts of genocide against the people in its war of aggression. It established a puppet government that oversees its interests. And it also, U.S. imperialism also protected and furthered feudalism in the Philippines, because they found it beneficial to gain the political support of the principalia, the landlords, the traders of the revolution. And they continued to use the hacienda system because it was a way for them to export raw materials from the Philippines and also exploit the peasantry through forced labor and also by, you know, getting land rent. And on the other hand, like, while saying that, imperialism also dumped finished products from the U.S. that are being bought by the Filipino masses at a higher price, like much higher prices. So what I'm talking about now is still existing in the Philippines. The hacienda system and the exporting of raw materials, the use of cheap labor, etc., is still an ongoing crisis in Philippine society. So imperialist interests intentionally allowed only, you know, a limited, unbalanced and irregular level of capitalist development in the Philippines to render the Philippines export-oriented and import-dependent. So, you know, it also perpetuated its colonial rule by the means of counter-revolutionary violence and means of deception, while also training puppet leaders who would help run the colonial government while U.S. is still directly being in control of the country. So due to the worsening conditions during this time, the armed resistance of the people continued in different parts of the country. And then eventually, the establishment of the Communist Party of the Philippines in 1930 marked like the unity of the toiling masses as the leading force of the revolutionary struggle of the Filipino people. So when the Japanese colonization began, the U.S. actually left the Philippines, its puppet government in the Philippines to fend off themselves, as they were much busier fighting Europe during that time. So there's actually a famous quote from MacArthur where he said, like, to the Filipino people that, you know, that he will be back. And so the Japanese aggressors exhorted the Filipino people to support its war of aggression in Asia. So the type of aggression that the Japanese did is similar to the other colonies that they had, you know, like we also had Comfort Women in the Philippines. We had the Bataan Death March where Filipinos were made to walk such a long distance that, you know, they end up dying throughout that march. And so similar to the U.S., the Japanese also set up a puppet government to oversee its interests in the Philippines. And then, yeah, but, you know, the Filipino masses, despite having another new occupier, continued in resisting them. And even before the Japanese came, the Communist Party of the Philippines already led a broad movement to boycott Japanese products. And then when the Japanese arrived in the Philippines, guerrilla warfare flared up. And the Hukbalahap, or Hukbong Bayan Laban sa Hapon, or People's Army Against the Japanese, was established. So they were the ones that broke the backbone of the Japanese aggressors, along, you know, with the heroic struggle of the broad Filipino masses. However, in, you know, U.S. imperialist fashion, they came back again when the revolutionaries were already been kicking out the Japanese colonizers. So they were already as well, like, you know, close to victory. And then the US came back and stole that again, and then made it seem like they were saving us from the Japanese, acting as if they were our heroes in this context. And then they justified their return by taking advantage of the economic devastation by, you know, through the bombardment of like the cities all over the Philippines. And so we would be dependent on their aid. And then it's like, you know, the ongoing continuing cycle of dependency on US imperialism, which, you know, they made those conditions to exist for us, for the Philippines to be dependent to them like that. So it continued the counter-revolutionary tactics in attempt to silence the toiling masses from vocalizing their demands. And they also dictated unequal agreements through its puppet government to ensure like the continuation of exporting and also exploitation. So actually, like, you know, like with your question, when you mentioned like from colonization to independence to now, I would like to clarify that the Philippines has never been independent. So in 1946, the US imperialists granted the Philippines sham independence. But in reality, we still remain as a semi-colony of the US. And, you know, we still continue the fight for national liberation. Because, you know, even like in that sentence itself of like the US granting the Philippines independence, why is our occupy is granting us the independence? So it's not actually genuine liberation, because they still, even though it may look like they don't have the direct control in the Philippines right now, we still remain to be a semi-colony of the US through the puppet government and through feudalism and imperialism. We are still continuing our fight against those problems.
I was hoping you...
It will not address the deep underlying issues that still pervade Australian society. And that primary issue is white Australian racism.
We've got a clear-cut case here of intentional genocide from the get-go, from the round table in England.
The true history in this country isn't told. The government always say that they're committed to a truth-telling process. Well, where is your truth-telling process?
I really believe that at the end of the day, the truth will emerge. You can't fight against the truth. It's an unstoppable force. It's indestructible. So deal with it.
3CR, stay tuned, stay radical.
And you're back, Wednesday breakfast. We just heard an interview I did with Sunday from Anuk Bayan Melbourne. That's the first part of a two-part interview where we were speaking about the history of colonization and imperial wars wrought upon the archipelago. And before that, we also heard an interview that I did with Marcus Rubenstein, who is an independent journalist, and we spoke about his column on Pearls and Irritations, the anti-China Media Watch column, which comes out weekly.
That was really... a powerful lesson. I think lots of elements of the imperialist playbook come through, and it's important to have that understanding to chart a way forward. I think the clarity in your conversation with Sunday was really
Sunday important. Is amazing. Like, yeah, they have so much knowledge, and I think they must have been studying their whole lives, because, yeah, they just know everything about everything. So, yeah, really lucky to be able to have a chat with them. about that, and yeah, like these histories are really kept hidden from us, you know, despite how relevant they are, you know, to us. You know, our governments are wholly involved in these things, or, you know, at least, you know, aiding and abetting, or, you know, at least friends with these people who are doing these horrible things. And so we have every reason, you know, to know about these things, but we just don't. And yeah, so it's a privilege to be able to learn and share that.
Yeah, absolutely. We will go to our next segment. It's a packed show, listeners. So the next segment is an excerpt of an interview that we'll be playing in its entirety on the Climate Action Show next Monday at 5 p.m. But today we listen to the first part of the interview. This interview is between Climate Action Show host Rosie and Jeremy Walker, who's a researcher who has done extensive work exposing the Atlas Network. Jeremy goes into how he found out about the Atlas Network, its history and its makeup, and his previous research and understanding about it. So listeners may know or will find out more today that the Atlas Network is an internationally coordinated body that has been working behind the scenes for years to shape public opinion and government policies that favor corporate interests and profits. So let us have a listen to what they're up to, especially ahead of the election next month.
Jeremy, you've done incredible work over many years to understand and expose the operations of the Atlas Network. Yet I'd say the vast majority of Australians have never heard of it. So would you mind just explaining what the Atlas Network is and how it's been able to pretty much shape world politics, particularly in relation to the fossil fuel industry?
Okay, thank you. The way I came to be studying the Atlas Network was I've been reading for a long time as part of my, you know, research into the history of neoliberal economics, because the Atlas Network, the reason people haven't heard about it is because they're not supposed to have heard about it. But people probably have heard of the Institute of Public Affairs and Melbourne, which has been around for a long time, and the Centre for Independent Studies here in Sydney. And you might have heard also about the Heritage Foundation in the States with the Project 25, which is the kind of large pre-planned 900-page document, which seems to be being executed very rapidly under presidential orders in the state. But the thing that really brought me into it was that I was kind of baffled by why it was that for a very long time scientists were saying that we have to radically reduce fossil fuel combustion, otherwise the Earth will become increasingly and irreversibly hotter and hotter and hotter, and there's no real end date to that as far as we know. But I became interested in it because when you started to hear people, you know, from the early 90s coming out and saying, I know the science isn't settled and there's a lot of debate about whether it's really happening. But nearly all the time it was economists who were saying this, and economists don't have any expertise in the realm of physics or climate science or global ecology. So I thought it was very strange that people would be saying this so often. And when I looked into it, I realized that all of these economists tended to be people who were part of the Mont Pelerin Society, which was established in 1947 by Friedrich Hayek, Austrian Nobel, and Milton Friedman, and a whole lot of similar-minded laissez-faire economists. And then when I scratched into it a little further, I realized, in fact, probably all of the statements going right back to 1988-89, saying that we shouldn't do anything about climate change, or it wasn't real, or it was bad, or we shouldn't have a UN treaty that strictly timetabled phase out of fossil fuels, we shouldn't have carbon tax. All of these things were coming out of these institutes, which also had these economists on their boards. And then when I started to realize that all of these institutes were affiliated with an organization called the Atlas Network. So the original Atlas think tank, the Atlas Network itself, has a number of meanings. So in the first instance, there's just a legal entity called the Atlas Economic Research Foundation, which was started in 1981, registered in the tax secrecy state of Delaware in the US. And its role was to litter the world with free market think tanks. So the Atlas Foundation, as the name suggests, was originally established as a way of putting money together from very wealthy donors and large corporations to propagate more and more of these free market think tanks. And its founder was Anthony Fisher, a wealthy British World War II pilot who came from a family that owned one of the biggest coal mines, not incidentally, in the UK. And in 1947, the British Labour government nationalised all of the coal mines in Britain. And not long after this, you know, Fisher becomes incensed with this new post-war settlement around the welfare state and public control of fossil fuel resources. And then he, in 1955, he establishes the Institute of Economic Affairs, which is the first neoliberal think tank in London. And no one, until recently, we didn't know who was paying for it. But from the beginning, it was Shell and Rio Tinto, BP, and other large international mining companies and banks that finance and so on. And then this was very effective. So by 1979, when Margaret Thatcher was elected, she gave the Institute of Economic Affairs the credit for changing the climate of opinion, which made her government possible. In 1975, he was invited to Canada by, again, petroleum and mining interests to set up the Fraser Institute. That was the first neoliberal think tank outside of the UK. Then he came to Australia in 1976 at the invitation of John Bonython, the founder of Santos, to have secret meetings with wealthy businessmen and people like Gina Reinhart, presumably. And then they set up one in Australia called the Centre for Independent Studies, and the first grants for that, the first long-term grants that made that possible were from Santos, Shell, Rio Tinto, BHP, which of course was in the oil business with Exxon in the Bass Strait, and Western Mining Corporation, which owned the biggest uranium mine in the world in Olympic Dam in South Australia. And as John Bonython said in a letter to another royal executive at the time, the point of this was to overcome the public opinion that supported the Whitlam Labor government in respect of national ownership and equity in the mining industry, land rights for Aboriginal people, environmental protections, and so on. And then by 1981, he was in such demand that he started this new organization, the Atlas Economic Research Foundation, and its job was not to be a think tank itself, but to mass produce think tanks all around the world. So to kind of train and vet and train talent to run these institutes and then put them together with money from a wealthy industrial or financial interests who wanted to change public opinion and influence government policy and block, you know, legislation or laws they didn't like. And so by 1988, when the climate issue suddenly appears on the front pages of the world's newspapers, later on that year, there's a letter we have, which is a publicly available internal PR letter from Exxon, saying that they would, their approach to this would be to emphasise in public, to government and to the public, that the science was uncertain about climate change. We know that's not true because as early as 1959, you know, the fossil fuel industry had been briefed by Edward Teller, the nuclear physicist who built the hydrogen bomb. He addressed the American Petroleum Institute in 1959 and warned them that, you know, at some point, unless we move to electric cars, fuel cells, solar power, you know, or nuclear power, of course, because he was obviously a nuclear advocate, that we would then, that, you know, that New York would go underwater and all the coastal cities would eventually end up being flooded. That was 1959. So there was no reason, there was no record anywhere between then and 1988 of the fossil fuel industry having any doubts that what they were dealing with was in fact completely correct and true from a scientific point of view. But in 1988, they decided they would basically embark on a campaign of deceiving the public. And not long after the very first book by a scientist saying that the science wasn't true, but it was by Fred Singer, was published. And that Fred Singer's address, when he retired from his university position, and then he started this thing called the Science Environmental Policy Project, and the address for that was the exact same address as the head office of the Atlas in Virginia. He was in the office next door to the Atlas Network's head office. So, you know, basically between 88 and at the present, the total size of the Atlas Network in another sense, so when we talk about the Atlas Network, it's really, we're talking about what's now at least 550 of these organizations that are aligned with, trained by, attend conference with, and coordinate strategy, and have, you know, meetings and conferences, which are, you know, usually entirely private and off the record. So that's the network as a total entity, a giant infrastructure for trying to manipulate public opinion and swing elections and insert their people into key government positions, whether as elected members of parliament or as, you know, running critical government institutions like, you know, the EPA or the Productivity Commission or the Reserve Bank. And so the network as a total entity is huge, and it's across 100 countries. So, yeah, there's a couple of ways in which you might think about what the Atlas Network is. Firstly, it's that single organization at the center of this giant web of influence and, I would say, disinformation and corporate propaganda. And then to think of the network as the totality of these 550-plus organizations, which they themselves claim as their partners. But even beyond that, we could, an even bigger sense would be all of the companies and private billionaires who invest in it, who are, you know, in the know and who provide the money to giant foundations in the US, which come from oil money, like the Scaife Foundation, Koch Foundation, which has built up the network in America. So there's something like 200 of the 550 worldwide are in North America. And that explains to me why we have this Trump phenomenon, because for decades the public has been bombarded with relentless, you know, aggressive denial that climate change is real and so on and so forth. And, so the largest sense would be all of those people, the funders, the think tank directors. But then, and there's another whole layer. So here in Australia, we have 7 Atlas think tanks that are on that list. But then there's all of these other ones that they spin off to do other things. So we've had there was the Lavoisier Society, which was created to, you know, spread anti-climate policy and anti-climate science disinformation in the kind of 90s. Then they set up the Bennelong Society to train Aboriginal voices that they could then use to attack legitimate representatives of land councils and elected bodies like that. This is where Jacinta Price and Warren Mundine came from, Advance. And then you've got Advance, which is not officially related, but was, you know, set up and funded by people on the boards of the Centre for Infant Studies and the IPA and so on. So there's always other groups out there, like, we don't really know where they came from, but it's likely that they were closely aligned, like Australians for Prosperity. There's been, you know, dozens have popped up in selection, all pushing similar lines as the main Atlas think tanks are. We need nuclear, you know, renewable power is too expensive, and so on and so on.
That's all very terrifying. Have other people before you attempted to expose this, or have other people known about it?
That's a good question. I think to put it this way, you know, as a scholar, you're one of the tools we use is Google Scholar, which indexes, you know, academic books and publications in academic journals. And if you put in the word neoliberalism, that's in the, you know, the philosophy that was created by and for these think tanks and propagated by them. The scholars were funded by the same, you know, oil interests that set up the network as well. And they publicised their work and printed it and put it out into the media, and then they'd buy copies for, you know, and they'd send it to libraries and flood, you know, and all that kind of stuff. So that there was always their messages everywhere. I think there's about, so if you put in that term neoliberalism into a search engine, you'll find there's something like 7 or 8 million academic papers that have looked at it as a ideology or as an economic, as the economics that's run, the economic theory and practice that's run the world since the early 80s probably. But very little of them have looked at the actual infrastructure that made that possible. There's been studies of individual think tanks. The DSMOG, the great resource, was started to track anti-climate disinformation, and they've more or less ended up mapping the Atlas Network without knowing it. So the Atlas Network has been very successful at disguising the fact that it is a coherent global entity, and also in disguising its funding. And so, yeah, there's very few people that have really looked into it as their main concern. It's been mentioned by several scholars in this literature. People have looked at it. People have been looking into the tobacco industry's, corruption of scientists and manipulation of public opinion, bump into the Atlas Network because they did that for cigarette companies as well. And so a lot of people have bumped into bits of it. And, you know, Jane Mayer wrote a book called Dark Money, for example, a New York journalist, and she profiled four very, very wealthy American families, the Decote family, the Scaife Mellon family, the Olin Foundation, the Bradley family, that set up four of the huge, big foundations, that allegedly charitable foundations, which are financed for decades, the building up of the Atlas Network in the States, but, you know, didn't notice the Atlas Network. So it's they've been very good at keeping themselves completely on the one hand, they have this thing where they're constantly pumping the public sphere full of their messaging and pretending that it's all independent voices. They call themselves non-profit independent research institutes, but and they never say on their own websites, if you go to the IPA, it won't say, we are a member of the Atlas Network and here's the other 550 members. It never says that on any of the other websites. So they give the public the impression that these are just, you know, legitimate independent voices, maybe with a conservative slant, but they're just individual organizations. But if you drill down into what they're saying, who the board members are, you see very much that they're very, that's actually a fairly small number of people, just with a lot of money behind them and a lot of power, and they're very well networked into, you know, governments and the right-wing parties, to the point where, for example, I would argue that they've taken over the Liberal Party of Australia. You know, there used to be wets in the party. They're all gone now. So, the answer is that very few people have really looked at it, but now there's a huge amount of attention. I know that there's a lot of scholars out there and journalists who are suddenly extremely interested in. Yeah. We're seeing a lot of really interesting things coming out now that people are actually focusing on the Atlas and what it does.
Yeah.
And we've been listening to Jeremy Walker lifting the lid on the Atlas Network, which is really network of 550 right-wing think tanks, each masquerading as an independent organization to shape public opinion. So I think behind them named the Center for Independent Studies, and yeah, pretty much anything you've read that's come across as a little polished piece telling you that, you know, climate change isn't real and people's rights don't matter and, you know, what's good for the economy is bad for people. Looks like it's the same people behind at all. What an interesting expose, I would say. And if you want to listen to the whole of that conversation, please tune into the Climate Action Show next Monday at 5 p.m. So we have one last segment, dear listeners, and this is quite a this is a speech from the start of a rally which was held yesterday in Footscray calling for justice for Abdi Fattah Ahmed, who was shot and killed by Victoria Police in central Footscray last Thursday on the 17th of April. And this particular speech has been given by Somali community leader Farah Warsame. And she speaks in the rally in both English and Somali, calling for unity, justice, transparency and accountability in the face of Abdi Fattah's entirely avoidable tragic death.
When we start our speech, we normally start by saying Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim, as we are Muslims here. And my name is Farah Warsame. And I stand here with all of you today, heartbroken and deeply saddened by the tragic death of the young African man of Somali background, taken from us last Thursday in Footscray, here in Footscray, at the hands of two police officers. This killing has shaken us all. As a community, we are in a deep grief, and we are still in a shock. This young man was one of us. He could have been our brother, our son, and our friend. We are here today because we want answers. We want a full, fair, and transparent investigation into what happened. We want justice. Justice for all. justice for all. Thank you. What we have seen on social media is very disturbing. That video has left many of us feeling hurt, confused, and angry. Traumatized as well. Thank you for adding that. If you haven't seen it, please know it shows something no one should ever have to witness. I have been in this country for almost 20 years. I've never ever seen such a tragedy before. I'm talking about the Somali community specifically. But even as we carry this bane, we must stay calm. We are not here to cause chaos. We have to know that. We are not here for violence. We are here to stand for the truth and to speak for someone who can no longer speak for himself. Allah yarham. Ilaun Haris. We are here to demand justice. But to do that, we need to do it with peace and unity. Let's remember, each one of us who have gathered here today has a responsibility. Please avoid any hateful speech. Please avoid actions that could divide us or harm others. If you see anyone doing something suspicious or unrelated to this peaceful gathering, I urge you to ask them to stop or report it to rally organizers. Sometimes in gatherings like this, people come with their own agendas. We are not here for politics. I have to mention that. It's very important. We are not here for politics. We are not here to promote any group or cause other than one thing: justice for a life that was lost. We are calling for the police officers involved to be held accountable for what has happened. This is not too much to ask. It's not a science rocket. We are just asking a justice. It's our right to demand that justice. Australia is a country where we have the right to protest and speak out peacefully. Let's honor that right by staying respectful and peaceful today. We are strong when we are united. Thank you for all being here today. I will say a few words in Somali as well, because that case man was from Somalia. So I'll be speaking a few words, just a couple of words in Somali, so that, because we have got a lot of people who might not understand the English language. So, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, wa salaam ya damantin. Muhimmadu hadalkay waxa ay ahayd in aan cadaalad u raadino wiilka yar oo walaalkeena halkan ku dhintay oo lagu dilay, in cadaaladda si aan raadino. Si aan cadaaladdaas u helno markaa, waxaan u baahanahay damantin in laga shaqeeyo la ilaaliyo. Nabaddu annaga u baahan oo ku dhool. Dad aragtaan qof annaga naga mid ah oo dhib sameeynaya, haddaad aragtaan joojiya oo gacanta qabta. Haddii uu diido oo la hadlana uu diido, ku u sheega dadka kale. Ma rabno dhibaato, mar walbana raaca instructionka ay siinayaan dadka hawshan soo qabanqaabiyey. Ayaga follow gareeya. Aad baa u mahadsantiin. Asalaamu calaykum waraxmatullaahi.
Thank you so much.
And we've just been listening to a speech that was held at yesterday's rally calling for justice for Abdi Fattah Ahmed, who was shot and killed by Victoria Police in Central Footscray last Thursday on the 17th of April. The speech was given by Somali community leader Farah Warsame. And now we will go to some community announcements about things that are happening in the course of the next few days.
Yeah, so we've got a few things to let listeners know about. Tomorrow night, Thursday, the 24th, there will be a dinner and film screening night at Camp Sovereignty, where they'll be showing the Our Warrior film documentary about Uncle Robbie Thorpe. And there will be some food, and everyone is also invited to stay overnight to camp because there will be a dawn ceremony the next day for Anzac Day at 6:30 a.m. at Camp Sovereignty. So yeah, you're welcome to stay, or you can come back in the morning at 6:30 a.m. for that one. This Saturday at Black Spark, there is an Earthseed gathering where they're celebrating Octavia Butler's novel, The Parable and the Sower. So they'll be speaking about that one from 3 to 6 p.m. on Saturday at Black Spark. And they're asking people to bring something from your own survival pack / go bag for show and tell. And they read and listen to some of the digital offerings they've collected if you check out the Black Spark Instagram. Also, the next day on Sunday, there's an Indigenous struggle, past, present, and future discussion and education session from 12 to 3 o'clock at Dadi Manwara at 558 High Street, Preston. And that will be led by the Community Defence Marshalling System, CDMS, with Uncle Gary Foley, where they'll be chatting about Indigenous struggle, past, present, and future. And finally, on Monday, April the 28th at 6:30 p.m. at the State Library, you might have heard just earlier, we were speaking with Sunday from Anak Bayan Melbourne. They're organising a mass mobilisation, in response to the Balakatan War Games. And you'll hear a bit more about the Balakatan War Games in the second part of the interview that we did with Sunday. But ostensibly it's war games or war preparations or, you know, these kinds of things that they all like to do together, including Australia, Japan, the US, and the Philippines. And, you know, it's seen as stepping up provocations against China. The Anak Bayan are organizing the mass mobilization on 6:30 p.m. on this Monday, April 28th, at the State Library. There's calling for no to foreign military intervention and no to propping up the fascist US Marcos regime in the Philippines.
And now we'll do a rundown of the show, just to remind you listeners of what we had on today. So we started the show with an interview with Marcus Rubenstein on China. This was the second part of the interview. The first part we played last week, and Marcus is a journalist who writes for Pearls and Irritations, and he writes about the anti-China media watch, which traces some of the history of China and Australia's relationship with China over the decades, which, as you know, is getting adversarial, as the US tries to make war on China with Australia, its vassal state.
Yes, and after that, we had the interview with Sunday from Anak Bayan, and we'll make sure to include the details of Anak Bayan's contacts, mainly their Instagram, so you can check out more about them. And they're also welcoming anyone who is interested to learn more and would like to support the work that they do. So we'll make sure to include that in the show notes.
What an excellent interview. After that, we played an interview with Jeremy Walker about the Atlas Network, which is a covert network of 550 right-wing, neoliberal, anti-climate change, you know, think tanks, anti-human rights, really, masquerading as 550 separate sort of academic think tanks, but ultimately they all have the same funders and really all vouch for the same corporate and anti-human interests. The whole of that interview will play on the Climate Action Show next Monday, so please have a listen.
Yes, and it's always a red flag when we see these so-called independent NGOs, not-for-profits. You know, they say they're not taking government funding or whatever, but often they're based, end up being based in Washington as well. So that's a big red flag and something to really look at when you're looking at information. And yeah, you really need to look hard to make sure, is this something that we can trust? And you know, maybe it is okay, but you know, maybe if they are based in Washington, it's like, okay, well, maybe that's okay. Maybe they're telling the truth, but maybe we should just forget anything that's based in Washington and, you know, find better sources for things that we're wanting to share.
Absolutely. Yeah. And finally, we listened to a speech that was held at yesterday's rally calling for justice into the police murder of Abdi Fattah Ahmed, who was killed by Victoria Police last Thursday. So thank you for being with us today and I guess, you know, staying alive another day to continue the struggle. Next up, we will have the show Stick Together, but wishing you all a beautiful day.
Have a wonderful day, everyone.
3CR Breakfast would like to thank the New International Bookshop, Melbourne's radical bookstore and venue, for their financial support of this program. You can find Nibs opposite reception in the Lygon Street wing of Trades Hall, Carlton. Keep up to date with upcoming events at nibs.org.au.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.